wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Hey, that sounded professional, that version. It was homegrown by two of our musicians, Joe and Clayton. Hi, folks. It's a pleasure and responsibility to tell you, yes, we are moles in the ground. In some ways, desecrated that ground. In many places, a ruined, toxified country and earth, as to the environment and its politics, but also a sacred ground, hallowed from the centuries of struggle. And now that struggle continues, and more intensely now in the time of Trump. Today, the old mole brings you three major struggles in our time. If we keep up the fight, we can, in fact, turn them in our favor. For one, today we discuss sanctuary cities and the struggle to protect workers who came to this country without documents. Also today, Buy America and economic nationalism. Is it good for the working class? What, in fact, do the great ordinary folks of this country, ordinary folks, of course, of an extraordinary species, what kind of overall economic policy would be good for them? First today, though, we discuss energy, solutions to the climate crisis. Last week, we played part one of an interview with Jessica Tovar. She's an organizer with the California Local Clean Energy Alliance. We discussed that many counties in California, pursuant to California law, they're taking over the electric power utilities, replacing the big corporate utilities. And in fact, those counties and cities are producing sun and wind energy and supplying it to people at much lower cost to ratepayers than the corporate monopolies. We should note that several other states, like California, have what's called community choice aggregation laws. But not Oregon, whose legislators and city councils are very highly influenced, one could say in the pocket of Pacific Power and PGE. In part two today of the Tovar interview, we discuss how California's corporate utilities are spending now hundreds of billions of dollars of customer money trying to regain their monopoly. So far, they've been defeated, however, by California's very militant and active clean energy movements. This story and many others on energy democracy is told in the book. It's titled Energy Democracy. Today it's a premium. We give it to you free as a premium for becoming a member or renewing membership in this week's KBOO membership drive. More on the book and KBOO later. First, here's Jessica Tovar on protecting California's community local energy system from the corporados who want to regain control and are spending millions to do it. Jessica Tovar, we've been talking about the immense benefits of community choice aggregation and community. That's the name of the program for all of California, and particularly the way Alameda County is implementing it and building out on the local level. The big utilities of California, what California Edison and PG&E and maybe a few others, the tremendous operations with huge financing, big world corporations finance, the banks all over the world finance them, and they're an enormous capital asset. They're now going to run the distribution system and charge for it and make a little bit of money in comparison to what they used to make. How did they ever lose?
That's a good question. You know, with PG&E here in the East Bay Area, they're looking at different ways to actually tax us for starting community choice energy programs. An example of that is that they do charge an exit fee. So if you are starting a community choice energy program, PG&E is pretty much charging a fee for their loss. And us as ratepayers, we have to pay into that. Our programs, our community choice energy programs, have to pay an exit fee. And since they do still own the grid, they're also charging transmission access charges. And so these different types of fees that these investor-owned utilities charge, we actually have to fight as well. So Local Clean Energy Alliance, along with other groups in the state of California, have actually established a statewide entity to kind of be on guard when it comes to this kind of policy. I call it the CASE, joking around, but it's California Alliance for Community Energy, and so that's the statewide body. So yeah, that is an issue, and as you can imagine, PG&E was never happy with community choice energy. As a matter of fact, recent history shows that they have, through their union, fought community choice at the statewide level and have fought also at some degree in the local level. For us, it's been very important to galvanize, like I said, the various community stakeholders, including unions, to address this issue and really educate and support community choice energy. And one of the important things I think that we did is bring different unions together, including some of the unions that were not friendly traditionally to community choice energy, but actually have discussions with them about how this could be a huge jobs creator in the community. So that is one of the things that a lot of the unions see in addition to addressing the issues of climate change and environmental justice in the community.
The unions were really hostile to IBEW workers within PG&E. They were afraid for their jobs, and they were very hostile. And they supported, along with, of course, PG&E, this. What they did is they put a referendum, an initiative on the California ballot that would essentially have the impact of killing off what you're trying to do, of stopping community choice aggregation by making it far more expensive, as they're yep. trying to do still in other ways. But it's still a big loss to them and a big loss to the people who finance them. They're going to take a bath in terms of gross profits and size at some level. In any event, the unions spent like $30 million, which at that time was a lot of money for an initiative.
Right.
The people who were supporting community energy had less than $500,000. Tell us what happened in that struggle.
Sure. So what you're referring to is the California Assembly Bill 2145. And I forget what they called it, but yeah, it pretty much was an attack against community choice energy at the statewide level. And it was very much carried by IBEW 1245, which is the union that represents PG&E. So again, a huge fight. And this is what's really important to us, is really having huge alliances. We have an alliance at the local level called the East Bay Clean Power Alliance. We have a statewide alliance, the California Alliance for Community Energy. So really getting, again, a lot of the different stakeholders at the statewide level and organizing together to fight this huge attack on community choice energy. You have to understand there is a lot of other activists, advocates for community choice energy throughout the state of California who have been trying to get their local electeds to take on community choice. So working with these different advocates throughout the state, we were very fortunate to beat AB 2145 and actually preserve that policy to begin starting community choice energy programs in the different cities and counties that make up California. And that, again, Local Clean Energy Alliance can't do it alone, so it's very important for us to band together with all the different environmental, climate justice, social justice groups, and even other unions who support community choice energy has been very, very instrumental in winning that fight.
Jessica Tovar, tell us about the efforts that were made by the Local Clean Energy Alliance and many others to bring the unions on board, particularly, of course, the IBEW, that was the union for PG&E workers.
Well, it definitely took years of organizing and building relationships with different community groups, specifically different unions. And one thing that's been really key is building relationships with a lot of other unions was very important. A lot of unions see the importance of fighting climate change, specifically after Hurricane Sandy that hit New York. A lot of unions came together to address these issues because it affects their union members, their communities, and it affects their jobs. If there's huge flooding and storms, people are out of work and people are out of a home. So Hurricane Sandy definitely brought together or really hit home for a lot of union folks. And here in the East Bay area, we worked with a lot of different groups, specifically the California Nurses Association, AFSCME, SEIU. And at the same time, a lot of these groups came together and started their own kind of climate and environmental justice caucus. So already doing that education with union members. So it was really exciting for people to be able to come together on an issue that can actually address solutions. So a lot of those unions really sat with us, including IBEW 1245 that represents PG&E. And that union peer pressure enabled us to get a unity platform that we fought for at the local level with the local supervisors to get that commitment for the local development and the community in the governance of the program. The unions were able to see, yeah, this is very beneficial to our membership, to our unions, and creating jobs. I mean, these electrical unions are going to be hiring and getting a lot of these project labor agreements out of this program. And so seeing that there's so much opportunity and benefit, they actually agreed to work with us to fight to get that commitment.
Is that true of all of the building trades, like the carpenters? There will be not only electricians, but the plumbers, the carpenters, the concrete people, all of those, the unions that represent them.
It actually was the entire Alameda Labor Council that signed off on this unity clause. So under that labor council is the building trades, is the different electrician unions, is all the unions pretty much in Alameda County. So once we got that labor council to sign on, all those unions automatically are involved.
Well, you have a great labor council in Alameda County, don't you?
Well, I have That's to important. Say it's every step along the way is a struggle. It didn't end right there. We're still working and trying to work together. So we're definitely at a phase now where we're trying to bring everybody back to the table so that we can have a more unified voice. And that doesn't happen without organizing.
And it seems to me it's a possibility that once community energy gets started and you have your local community choice aggregation agency and the various communities involved and the unions and others involved, and seeing solar panels sprouting up and other forms and people being involved in creating their own energy, neighborhoods, schools, churches, all sorts of people actually are now erecting solar panels in anticipation. Once that happens, it could create a culture of energy conservation. If you use a lot less energy, you save a tremendous amount of money that would go into just building energy facilities, even if they're local. And energy conservation seems to me really important, as well as like support for electrified mass transit, electric automobiles, all of the building insulation and building standards. All of those things are part of at least dealing with climate change and reducing the greenhouse gas emissions. Do you see that happening in Alameda County? Is community choice aggregation and the progress you're making also leading to strengthening, let's say, the public transportation efforts and the electrification of transport efforts? There's all of these things going on. Building codes.
Yes, exactly. So pretty much within community choice energy, in addition to those clean energy jobs, there's opportunities for energy efficiency jobs, for example. And as you had mentioned earlier in terms of conservation, we would be definitely using a lot less energy or actually using cleaner energy locally. And one of the things we do want to see is an emphasis in demand reduction, or that's the fancy term for conservation, right? People actually addressing using less during peak hours. So there is an opportunity for that within a community choice program. And people are talking about the electrification of transportation. But one thing I like to remind folks is that until we can clean up our source of electricity, electrification won't address climate change, right? If we're getting energy from a dirty source or from a faraway source, or through clean energy credits that are is actually greenwashed energy. So we really make it a point to educate people that we do need to clean up our electrical grid and really make it truly clean energy. And with that, we are talking a lot about the electrification of public transportation and transportation, right? There's a lot of electrical cars now on the market, and that's only going to grow over time. So if we can clean up our source of electricity and make it truly clean, then when you do plug in your car, your electric car, or run your trains by electricity, then you know it's actually truly clean, not just locally, but on a larger scale than that. So that is really important to us, and it certainly is a benefit of community choice energy.
Jessica Tovar, I just want to congratulate you. It must be really feeling great, the position you're in now. Sort of in some ways, it's a culmination of a lot of work by a lot of people and a lot of struggle and organizing over many years. Really, California definitely leads the world and is so far ahead of Oregon, our clean and green state. It's so highly promoted as clean and green, basically run by the investor-owned utilities, but not California. Look, these are wonderful times. Congratulations, but keep up the good work. You know, the devil's in the details, of course.
Okay.
So make sure the details are good. I know that you folks know that, and you have the power to make sure it happens. You have the community behind you, I think, I hope.
We're definitely fighting for clean power to the people. That's what we like to say.
Oh, that's a good line. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
All right. Thank you so much.
Right. So long.
Next on the Old Mole, Mole Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss immigration, the sanctuary movement, and the Trump administration trying to destroy that movement. Jan and Mike.
Well, Attorney General Jeffrey Sessions visited the Rose City last week, another whistle stop in his national crusade against immigrants and sanctuary cities. Sessions spoke to a group of federal prosecutors and immigration agents as activists demonstrated outside the Portland field offices of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration. Well, Mike, tell us about the significance of the Sessions visit, and how does this crackdown on immigrants through the Department of Justice resonate with local policing? How does the rubber meet the road here?
Well, Sessions is our preeminent fearmonger right now. He's trying to rustle up a crime wave at his talk about Portland's murder rate and about how since the 80s, people have been, like him, have been doing the hard work of busting criminals, but now crime has returned. He uses, as he usually does, absolute deception and outright lies about his statistics. For example, he said the Portland murder rate has gone up by 140% between 2013 and 2015. Had he noted 2016, he would have noted that the murder rate dropped from 34 to 20, or more than a third. He cherry-picked carefully among tiny numbers where two or three murders will make or break a statistical change. He then excoriated Portland for being a sanctuary city and said that it was critical to cooperate with federal law enforcement officials, with ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But there is a law in effect in Portland and in Multnomah County, and has been since 2014, that forbids any local law enforcement official from turning over anybody to ICE unless there's probable cause. It's a U.S. Constitution Fourth Amendment guarantee. He is essentially asking sheriffs and police chiefs to violate a federal order.
So there's some contention about what law and order means, in a sense.
Well, that's right. His bias is consistently toward bigger and bigger government and more resources and authority delegated to bigger government.
But a bigger government that's heavy on the military and policing functions of the state.
Exactly. But you know, he has very little power in the area of normal crime and punishment. He's got immense power in the area of immigration law.
So could you say a little about the resistance of sheriffs and law enforcement agencies to this massive display of power that ICE represents and how that does resonate with local policing?
Well, police all over the country are very reluctant to do what Sessions would have them do because they are charged with enforcing the law every day. They go into every part of every community on a daily basis to deal with panicky calls and all the problems that ensue from law enforcement. And they're afraid that if they make arbitrary detentions for reasons they're not at all clear, simply because they've been dictated to by a federal law enforcement agency, that that will seriously contaminate their relationship with big swaths of the communities that they're in charge with enforcing the law. So they don't like it.
But during the Obama administration, Obama rolled out this whole Safe Communities program that set much of this in motion around working hand in glove between policing and the FBI and ICE databases, that police would cooperate in those kinds of raids.
Well, it's always been an uneasy relationship between local law enforcement and the feds, sometimes close, sometimes very distant. But this round of enforcement is not going well for Sessions because he has little power. For example, in Chicago, he tried to punish Chicago for being a sanctuary city. But what was at stake was $1.5 million, because there are some federal grants to cities and counties around the country, but they're really tiny, a very small proportion of any law enforcement budget or any criminal justice budget. So Sessions lost that anyway, because the judge said the city had a high likelihood of succeeding in saying that he cannot condition the award of grants on complying with enforcement of principles and laws that are very dubious. ICE is actually requesting local cops to turn over people to them without providing reasons for doing that.
Now, one of the dilemmas at the local levels, the limits also of the sanctuary city movement and what it means to have a sanctuary city. Some people don't like that term because instead prefer terms like safe, because there is no ultimate sanctuary. So one can downplay the power of ICE as well, and particularly now in the fate of many of these so-called dreamers. What about those limits? Because you're saying they don't have a lot of power, but at another level they do. Once ICE picks you up, they have enormous power at their disposal to determine the fate of people they do arrest.
Well, that's true. Once they've got you, they can incarcerate you indefinitely anywhere they want in the country. So the immigration law aspect of what Sessions is doing, he's got terrific power. The DACA, or the deferred children who came here at the age of 12 months, you know, he was their point man for saying that the program to extend citizenship, aspects of citizenship to these dreamers, is going to be canceled, because nobody else wanted to say it, because all the rhetoric from the Trump administration about dangerous immigrants.
They're murderers and rapists, and this doesn't fit with the dreamers, don't fit with the narrative.
No, they don't at all. I mean, when you come here, it's hard to say that somebody who comes here when they're 12 months old is going to be a menace to society.
But that also has been problematic throughout the narrative of the dreamers, because it relies very heavily on this idea that you shouldn't suffer the sins of your parents, that these are children who come here through no fault of their own. They're aspiring to fulfill the American dream. It's a kind of conservative narrative, and it sets aside the situation of their parents who chose to come here under various constraints. So there's also the issue of what draws adults here and the hypocrisy of the administration, the ruling class in this country.
Well, of course. I mean, there is not only a pull, but there's also a huge push because of our policies in places like Honduras, where we summarily dismissed a duly elected president. We've got horrific policies up and down Central America that have led to people fleeing for their lives. And there are people with asylum applications up and down the border who are absolutely frozen right now. That's true. The best thing about DACA, I think, is it's not doesn't pretend to be a comprehensive analysis of the situation with the Trump administration, but it just absolutely undercuts their whole rationale. It is fundamentally
racist. The demonizing of particularly brown people.
Yeah. There's no actus reus or mens rea or criminal activity whatsoever in these people. So the only conceivable justification is race.
To me, what's been important is this emphasis on how integrated immigrants, including people who are here without papers, are in the economy and the culture and the communities in the U.S.
Well, we would not be, I mean, it's a truism, but that doesn't make it any less true, that we would not be what we are without immigrants. A steady flow of immigrants has always been essential and a fundamental driving force behind the development of every part of this country.
And that's why the ruling class or ruling powers are often very divided around immigration policies, not only around policing, but on other kind of fault lines. And so that's something maybe to take up as we continue to follow this issue.
Well, there are huge splits between big business people who have always relied on immigrants and black people as to lower the wages and to increase the labor pool versus people with a more socially conservative view or more race-based view. That's like the big split on the issue of civil forfeitures, where Jeff Sessions is a complete government man who wants to be able to seize money even when there's no charge from anybody who's ever arrested, and versus the libertarian right who are appalled by it. So there are fractures here and there that we can and should take advantage of.
Yeah. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about Attorney General Jeffrey Sessions' recent visit to the Rose City and his unwelcome responses here.
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Mike and Jan. This, of course, report was on immigration. Next on the old mold, Denise Morris. She talks about the Buy America campaign and is it good for working class people?
Like Right to Work, Buy American has a pretty good ring to it. Both sound like programs that ensure the working class will benefit and thrive. In fact, many in union leadership believe broadening Buy American regulations is the path to prosperity and understand it to be a patriotic fair trade value. Quote, the Buy American and Hire American executive order could help jumpstart an investment in domestic production that would employ U.S. workers and boost the economy at the same time. It outlines federal procurement policies that focus on utilizing goods, products, and materials made in this country. Most importantly, it directs federal agencies to reduce the use of waivers and exemptions that have allowed them to bypass Buy American laws up until now. This is from a June 2017 Huffington Post editorial co-signed by union presidents representing Teamsters, auto workers, and machinists, and aerospace workers. It was this past April 2017 when Trump signed his executive order to Buy American and Hire American. Reporters from New Yorker and Forbes magazine called the executive order puzzling and a lot of smoke and mirrors. At the same time, union leadership said, quote, we hope the administration and the Congress will work together to strengthen Buy American laws and regulations. Fast forward to August 2017, and we see AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka quit Donald Trump's business council, not because he questioned the value of Buy American, but because, quote, it has become clear that President Trump has no intention of following through on his commitments to working people. More worrisome, his actions and rhetoric threaten to leave America worse off and more divided. It is for these reasons that I resigned yesterday from the President's Manufacturing Council. And in fact, the council was disbanded after a string of resignations. Is Buy American good for the working class in the U.S.? Chris Brooks, writing for Labor Notes, interviewed Dana Frank, history professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of Buy American, The Untold Story of Economic Nationalism, about the history and impact of these campaigns. Responding to Trump's recent executive order and its likely impact, Dana Frank explains, "You can see Trump here playing the anti-immigrant card, trying to turn working people in the U.S. against immigrants so we won't point the finger at plutocrats like Trump and his cabinet." The nationalism of his slogans play right into this as he tries to split the U.S. working class. Buy American campaigns operate on the assumption that if you buy a product made in the United States, then the company making the profit off that sale is going to reinvest in good union jobs in the United States. But that is very rarely the case. The companies didn't agree to that partnership. They have instead used these profits to lobby for free trade agreements that grease the skids for them to go overseas. People who might think they can separate out some sort of progressive version of Buy American will ultimately be unable to escape its sliding into Hire American or American First, and the notion that the United States shouldn't be concerned with the struggles of working class people in other countries. Buy American campaigns became popular in the late 1970s as working people were trying to address capital flight and employers began turning on unions demanding concessions. Again, these campaigns had a very strong racist component. People thrashed Japanese cars, even ones that were made by union workers in Japan, and Japanese cars made in the United States with union labor. This wasn't just the auto workers, but many manufacturing unions. The garment workers launched an anti-Asian Buy American campaign, but had to back away from it due to pressure from Asian American activists. Like people in the 1970s, people today want to return to the so-called golden age when there were lots of jobs in heavy industry that were union, paid really well, and provided excellent benefits. They imagine that Buy American might help to bring all that back. The problem is that employers have long since turned on the labor movement and driven down working conditions so far that it is very hard to return to that world. The strategy being pursued by employers today is totally different from what unions faced in the 1950s and 60s when steelworkers and auto workers had these great jobs. I find it tragic that the U.S. labor movement would follow Trump into his trap. Already some labor leaders are saying, yes, let's build the Keystone XL pipeline using union products made in the USA. And then, of course, Trump exempted the Keystone Pipeline from his own Buy American pledge. Elite support for Buy American campaigns has almost always contained that kind of hypocrisy. We do have to figure out what alternative progressive trade policies look like. We need to be talking about a third path that puts labor rights and union protections first as part of a broader package that also addresses immigration, committed to raising working people's wages and working conditions all over the world. And as our very own old mole Bill Resnick observes, quote, "The establishment media poses the trade struggle as between those who favor free trade as opposed to those who favor protectionism, and neglect to point out there is a third option, fair trade, where, unlike free trade's many rules and regulations that protect and enhance the power of multinational capital, fair trade protects workers and the environment in every country." I've been reading selections from Chris Brooks' interview with Dana Frank last May 2017. You can find the full interview and a link to her book, Buy American, The Untold Story of Economic Nationalism, at labornotes.org. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, thank you, Denise. Thanks for quoting me, in fact. So I want to give thanks to the people who called, a number of them. I think Linda's mentioned all their names. It's terrific. Thank you. I also want to thank the people who have done the show, particularly Jessica Tovar, who's a wonderful organizer in California. And I am being asked to conclude. So let me say this and thank our ace engineer, wonderful engineer, Patricia. You can hear this show or any part of it again or any of our previous shows or recommend us for friends. Just tell them to go to the web to Kabu and on top right the search box and type Old Mole and you get it. Join us again next week for more news, views, interviews from the Mole's underground working class perspective on Bill.